Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. I thought today we would do one of our old-fashioned type episodes where we simply grab the mind like a big piece of taffy and we just start stretching it and pulling it and rolling it and tax our mind a little bit. There's been an interesting sort of, I think, threshold that's been crossed when it comes to the public sort of getting to a point where they acknowledge reality and the fact that perhaps there's different types of realities. And, you know, we've talked about reality several times on this show from all kinds of perspectives. What I want to do with this episode is talk about it and bring together everything that we've ever considered to be reality. The fascinating thing to me is that there's some of you out there that are just born deep. You have old souls. And you were thinking about this, even maybe, if not consciously, subconsciously as a child. You're looking at the world and you're thinking, where the hell am I? You know, what is this place? But just as soon as you have that thought, paradigms start dropping on you like parachutes, right? Like a supply crate drops, and it's just like Gilligan's Island, man. It opens up, and inside, religion, right? Or cosmology, you know, scientific, like astronomy cosmology. Cosmology is actually a very generic word that really means a paradigm of reality. The spiritual realm is a cosmology. God's realm is a cosmology. Our realm is a cosmology. What's fascinating about it is that one of the biggest indicators that we have that there are infinite combinations of these realities is the numeric system. The numeric system, counting in numbers and doing anything mathematical, without even being good at math, you can feel it. You can't count up to the highest number, and you can't count down to the highest negative number, the lowest number, right? And you know that from a particular number, there's infinite decimal places. So technically speaking, you can divide something infinitely. And so right there is sort of an intellectual clue from whoever created this place that you really exist in an infinite paradigm in all directions. But human beings don't like to think about things like that, do we? We just don't. I mean, that's some heavy stuff, right? So we approach it from different metrics, right? We want to say, okay, well, I can't think about every infinite concept and reality all at the same time, right? I'm only a human being. As long as I'm trapped inside this flesh bag and I don't have a direct Ethernet connection, a gigabit connection to the universe through my pineal gland, I'm going to have to deal with these finite instances of infinity. And that's your brain, your body, perhaps the portion of your soul that connects to this vessel. And that's sort of like your immediate paradigm of existence, what you're aware of. Now, as we always say on this show, they always say we have five senses, which is definitely the five that we experience at the most profound level, right? Taste, smell, touch, all these different things. The interesting thing is once you go over five, then you're going to have to start getting into the divisible nature of these feelings that you have. For some of you that can see auras on people, well, that's a whole nother sense that a lot of us don't have. Some of you can have premonitions. I have premonitions from time to time. And what's interesting about my premonitions is I've never had a trivial premonition to my knowledge. It's always been someone's hurt. I had one before 9/11 happened where I said, I think something really horrible is going to happen and it's going to involve planes. I didn't say planes were going to hit buildings and because maybe they didn't. But they were involved. It's part of the PSYOP-y story, right? Well, they were definitely involved in the narrative, right? Scientists create machines, and machines are only allowed to sense sort of what they acknowledge as existing, right? For instance, they can sense electrons, and so they'll go for the electron set of machines that basically sense those different frequencies. And they have all kinds of different names for these frequencies. Same stuff, different frequency, different designation. They can sense potentially particulates in the air and say it's smoky, it's not, it's probably smells like strawberries in here. But because they haven't advanced beyond those basic machines, and believe me, those are basic machines when it comes to the indivisible nature of this entire place. In terms of the mass energy that we're willing to acknowledge as a common person in this world, before you get into Nikola Tesla, before you get all the way back to Faraday and others who sensed ether, right? They won't allow you to get any accolades for thinking outside the box because they have a club and you're not in it. And you don't really want to be in it because it's called the Closed Mind Club. They pat themselves on the back. They give themselves awards, trying to make everyone feel inferior if you don't adhere to their Neil deGrasse Tyson clubs. But the sad nature of it for them is that they're going to die having been given potentially decades and decades of time on this planet that could have been used to expand where they were headed in the first place, right? And isn't it nice to be free? Isn't it nice to be free to think about whatever the hell you want to think about? And there's no overlord on top of you, no overseer, officer on top of you. And that's sort of the foundation of where I want to start talking about where we are. What if all of these research projects that have spent billions and billions of dollars, and it could be all bullshit, could be they've acknowledged that they've done this, but I'm saying it could have been just a money laundering scheme. But if you listen to all of the various reports of at least America and Russia, our respective two countries have put in billions of dollars at the intelligence level to research all of these things that they say don't exist, like telekinesis, mind control without MKUltra stuff. We're talking about old-fashioned, man may have been able to do this natively, and now man has been taught to not think like that anymore, and therefore we can't do it. But some people can because they're just born with that recessive gene and they can do it. What if they have discovered, well, you know, we definitely have indications, which means little moments of proof that there's a whole lot more going on here than meets the eye. Now, the other side of the game is that potentially we've got people that have flown over an ice barrier and seen a whole nother world with a bunch of different continents. Potentially, when they go way up in the atmosphere, they see a different place than your average globe in your classroom or the library. But then they go up again and it's different. You imagine that? Well, one time it looked like it was a disc with turned up edges, and the other time it looked like a flat square. And the other time where the fuck are we? Right? And so they may understand that there's a subjective nature to reality based on the consensus of all of our beliefs. And as men grew to know other tribes of men and share the stories, the world got really bizarre. We all agreed that there was a continent we could stand on. But what that's standing on, well, maybe still up for debate. And so we're being prodded. Because somewhere down inside of us, we can sense that something is not right. You may believe, hey, look, I believe we're on a globe. But I sure as hell don't feel like I'm turning 1,000 miles an hour when I'm sitting in Mexico City. I just don't. Or Cairo. I don't feel like I'm moving that fast. How is it possible that a plane flying from Cairo to London, which is reducing probably about 600 miles per hour on a longitudinal direction, which means side to side, it's somehow naturally slowing down 650 miles an hour as it flies. And I'm not trying to make this a flat earth versus globe earth conversation, but what I'm trying to do is to get you to see we're getting really emotional about where we believe we are. And what's interesting is I know that if some people were in the same room having these conversations, they might go to blows. That's not good. But what's interesting about that premise being a reality is that all it does is it expresses how absolutely passionate we are about knowing where the hell we are. And that's what's important, not the eventuality. What if you're both right? What if you're both right? If you believed you were on a globe, and you solemnly believe that, then maybe you are on a globe. But guess what? You also believe in all the other science that would hold you down to a globe and make you not feel like you're moving. So you get that reality too. Someone who believes they're on a flat disc, well, that's where they are. But you know what? Both of you would believe in a pressure system of some sort that would give you the same exact day-to-day ability to go in a room and have a conversation. But both of you are right. What if the reality that we accept is the one that is? Why is it that successful people often get accused of that reality distortion field? I've mentioned it several times on the show. They simply fall uphill. It's crazy. I have friends like this, like I've told you. Well, it might be more of a consensus reality for an individual than it is for a group of people. But then you have things like dreams. Dreams, dreams, dreams. Dreams are one of the most amazing proofs that where you think you are, you may not be. Because even as a child, when you dreamed, you could project things into your dream that don't exist in the real world, at least that you've ever tangibly seen. I say real world with flying quotes, of course. But there's no way you could have become a 3D model person, right? I had a dream when I was probably 9 years old before, you know, really any 3D software really existed. I mean, there was a little bit making commercial logos and that kind of stuff. But I dreamed that this, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 foot King Kong was rampaging broad daylight in my little town of Derby, Kansas. And I was running on a street and he was inside the track of houses and he's just like the old video game Rampage. He's just crushing these houses with his fist and he's pissed and he's running. I don't really feel like he knew I was there. I feel like he was chasing me, but I'm looking back over my right shoulder going, oh my God, what the hell's going on, right? It was terrifying, but fun at the same time because I didn't feel like he was going to hurt me. But I conceived of that. I conceived of all the kinetic animation. One, his body. Now, of course, I'd seen King Kong on television, but King Kong on television is way bigger than this guy. For some reason, my mind shrunk him down. But as his fists go down into the roof of a house, the wood was blasting everywhere. The shingles are blasting everywhere. Plumes of dust and smoke are going everywhere. Now, it wasn't catching anything on fire, which might have actually taken place. So my brain wasn't completely educated about the eventuality, but I'm 9 years old, seeing one of the best Michael Bay scenes that would ever been on film. How's that possible? If it's just, oh, your brain sorting things out on the end of a day. Oh, really? Really? Well, that's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing that my little tiny brain could come up with a Hollywood shot that would probably cost $1 million, right? With today's reduced prices. Reality, man. Isn't it interesting when you have a really deep dream, and it's, I mean, at least this happens for me, if, when I have a really deep dream where I'm in a really, really detailed environment, interacting with dream people, and by the way, I haven't done a dream episode in a long time, but over the last year, since my last dream episode, I told you guys I was never really good at talking to people in my dreams. It just didn't ever lasted very long. I talked to them and they'd, you know, be like me talking, them looking at me. Maybe someone said something and I heard it, but it'd be over within seconds. And now I have dreams where I sit down and talk to people for minutes. Continual conversations. They react. I react. It's crazy. But the point I'm trying to make is when I have a really deep embedded dream, it's just what I'm going to call it, where it is a reality. It has all of the environment accounted for. There's no like a video game blockage down the street, right? I can go wherever I want to go. When I wake up, it is much more difficult to transition into this reality. And what's interesting is usually we would say, well, that's just because you're really tired. And granted, there are those times when I get really tired and I don't get enough sleep. So I definitely wake up more tired. But when I have a really light dream, I've already had the deep dream. I woke up and I rolled back over, went right back to sleep. And then I wake up. I can get up much easier. The way it feels to me personally, and this is just an analogy, is that my soul is actually in that other realm. What is me is actually at that location. Did I create the reality? I don't know. Because it's a whole lot of reality that my mind creates. I mean, it creates roads and neighborhoods and houses and buildings and people and scenario that goes with that, right? I mean, where do I find the time? That's all I got to say. But it exists. Sometimes I go to sleep with a problem on my mind. I'm trying to write some code and I can't get the damn thing to work. And so my brain gives me almost like match three puzzles to try and try to get me through the problem. And that doesn't even feel like a dream. It feels like I'm staring at some weird iPad or something in my head. And boy, waking up from that's pretty easy. I once told you guys in the Origin of Man episode that we ran through the scenario, what if we were these infinite beings living forever? And we were just sort of the queue, living forever. Kind of can do whatever you can conceive of. But it got boring. And so we created this finite encapsulation, which is called life. You're born, you have a very short stay, it's a very detailed experience. You can fall in love, you can get murdered, you can get married, you can have kids, you can have no kids, whatever it is, it's a rich environment. You're going to find other souls that are playing this video game. And when they disappear, you're going to feel the value of life. And when you come out of that experience, instead of being a queue going, oh, there's that guy again, it's like, no, that's my dad from this one life. And we didn't have a great relationship, let's just say. And so now I get to be on the other side and have that great relationship. All of the misunderstandings that the earth provided are now moot. And it's not that I think anything matters once you die. I think when you die, it would be interesting to know whether or not there's any earth paradigms that we even care about. I had the experience at Disneyland where I feel like I bumped into Walt Disney, who told me where Bob Gurr was. Okay, well, if that's really what it absolutely looked like, you know, when it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, I don't tend to go much further than that. Maybe he's there for a reason. Maybe he's there protecting his park from the corporations that took it over and turned it into something he wouldn't have anything to do with. Who knows? I think we see proof every single day that the reality we think is that we're so sure of, okay, is the one. That's it. Those who believe the world is very secular and that when you die, there's just oblivion on the other side. I think that they've lived very busy lives. And imagine if that's the only formula you really need and that we know there's forces that make us work. There's forces that make us get, you know, monetized credits to get something we really don't need, and sometimes the stuff we do need, like food and shelter. But they know if they apply a lot of pressure on us to survive, well, then we get preoccupied with the loop of reality that is dictated by them. Get up, get cleaned up, get your kids into the institutional school so we can brainwash the living shit out of them. Now get over to that corporation and sit in that cubicle, stare at that thing and make me more money while you take home jack shit. You got no future, no retirement. And you know what? You're so stupid that you're doing this, you fucking deserve to die in a ditch is what they think. Your kids, well, fuck, you know, we're going to turn them into machines. Your drama teacher is going to take them down to get a sex change at 12 because we're going to pass all this legislation that makes that possible. And we're going to vaccinate them as soon as possible. So anyway, don't worry about that. There's no future for you. There's no future for your genes, all that kind of stuff. Maybe that's what ties us up and makes us bound to this reality. I'm old enough now to be hanging out with people that are, you know, within probably 5 or 10 years of their life. In some cases, I know people that are probably not destined to be alive in a year just because of age and maybe a medical condition that's eating them alive, right? And what's really crazy about it is that you see the internals of a man. I can't speak for women. But do you see these internal insecurities and almost what they think that they missed externalized the second they get close to death and the second they wake up in the morning and it's like, woof, one more day. Holy shit. Didn't know if that was going to happen. Men start to hoard things. when they get older. I know a friend of mine that owns probably $2,000 or $3,000 worth of super vintage Cuban cigars he bought 10, 15 years ago. The dude is about to die. He's probably within a year of his life. He won't smoke a single stick. And when we ask him, what the hell are you, why'd you buy them, man? They're probably dead up there anyway. They probably don't have any taste. You should smoke them. Find out. No, you can smoke them after I'm gone. But keeps trying to live another day. No matter how bad an illness takes a person down, just trying to win that contest where I'm going to be the oldest guy in my skin suit when it's all over. Trying to stay alive to live another day, but not willing to live that day to its fullest. What a bizarre paradox. He hasn't lost his mind. But I think it's because a lot of things come out of a person towards the end of their life, right? What's also interesting is that he's very loose with his previous disciplines. The guy is an engineer of like power plants. So he's not an idiot, right? He's a very, very astute man. He's also not uptight. He lived a good kind of hippie life back in the day. Definitely partied hardy when he was younger. And so when it came, was it 2015 when the big flat earth thing dropped? He was pretty fast until he's like, yeah, you know what? This makes sense. I no longer think I live on a ball. This guy's an engineer. And it's not about whether the earth is flat or round or anything, right? Or oblique or whatever. Or these other, I say those two things and I get like emails. Hey, you know, it's not really that, Jabe. It's like an inverted sphere, man. It's like, okay. The point is, we're all potentially living on whatever the hell we want to live on, right? The big question we keep asking ourselves and asking each other in conversations is, why do you think you're here? Why do you think you're here? I think most folks get to a point where they at least consider the following. You're here to learn something. You're being tested. Now, the tests in this world, in this paradigm, are given by an instructor of some sort of higher being than you, in terms of whatever academic silo you might be inside of, right? But what if the test was actually designed by you before you became human? What if we all just agreed on an ascension and we're all just trying to refine our souls to be more patient, more loving, more understanding, to live a better life? You know, as they say, you can work 18-hour days, or you can work 8-hour days, or you can work 4-hour days and get the same amount of work done, all three allocations. And the person that's getting it all done in 4 hours is working smarter. They're masters at what they do, so they can get a lot more done in a shorter period of time. Well, imagine that's human beings. You're a new soul. Maybe you were a kitty cat before, you were a dog before, you were a bovine, and now you're a human being. And you breathe with your mouth open. Well, next few generations, maybe a few hundred generations, you manage to get that chin up, breathe through your nose. You're less reactionary. You're more patient. And then what happens at the end of this whole thing, and I'm just making this up, but this is actually something I think that my dreams are indicating, quite frankly. You actually birth into another world, sort of an upgraded level, like a video game. And yes, I made video games for over 20 years, so the analogy is a little easier for me to believe. We'll get into that in 1 second. But what if you had a higher level of beings that still are using the human paradigm? It's just a mechanism. It doesn't matter if you're a spider person or a biped. It doesn't really matter. But you can't exist in that world yet because you're not sophisticated enough to be in that world. I would be in the same camp. I'm a little too reactionary. I'm a little too goofy. I'm too juvenile. And they're not. Their children are more mature than I am. Or maybe if I live to be 100 years old, whatever my maturity level is at that stage, their kids are that way at 5 years old. And so it would be uncomfortable for me to be in that world, and it'd be uncomfortable for them to have me in that world. And so it's just this infinite ascension. Maybe after we ascend and ascend, we go back, we go off into some realm where we become primitive again. Maybe we just become our pure energy in that other realm. And we sort of, you know, shed off the memories of what it was like to go through all those levels of the video game. And you go back to that freaking Zelda 1 and you push play again. You start playing Zork again and typing in your commands. And you're like, man, this was a lot of fun. Not really. But maybe you go through different forms of life. More responsibilities, more instrumentalities, more things to operate as a living being. Then you ask yourself, why are all these evil people so rewarded in this world? I mean, doesn't it seem like that's the case? It's an interesting thing that the world leaders of this existence have seldom been anything other than bastards, backstabbers, the narcissistic, the megalomaniacal people, with supreme races and all this other stuff. A lot of that is sort of feudalism, in my opinion, that people don't want to invest in what it would take to create an intelligent group of people where perhaps there is, in flying quotes, intelligent people. Again, intelligence is relative to your perception of reality. There's probably a cannibalist somewhere in the world that in their brain, they're doing everything that they're supposed to do. When they kill their enemy from a neighboring village, they eat them because that's the way they honor their death, is to consume them and learn everything that they learn by doing such. You know, you won't find me doing that anytime soon, but, you know, from their perspective, that's genius. The Tartarian movement is very interesting when you think about potentially what's gone on since we've been here, right? Now, I want to loop video games back in here because we talk about this every once in a while, and I think it's going to be an unbelievable moment where we're all going to learn something big. And for those of us in gaming, we've already seen it. We haven't seen the final product, but we've definitely seen where it's going. But let's put that on hold for 1 second. We know the history is bullshit. We know it's bullshit. It's written in front of us in bullshit ways every single day. Every single day something happens, they lie about what happened. And it's just right in front of your face and it's live. Again, like I said, the Matrix is being created in front of us live, and the Matrix would be a false reality that is controlled. It's never been more apparent that fake information is being presented all over the place. When you post a piece of truth and some piece of shit fact checker gets in there and says that it's not true, and then it becomes true. The Biden family alone has been a wonderful instrument in proving that the censorship is nothing more than censorship. All the rumors about their family have unilaterally been true. All right. And the only ones that have been validated are the ones that are being censored today, which will be validated in a year or so, right? Well, all of history is like that. Now, I don't personally believe that there was a Tartarian race by name and that they were somehow running around the world building things under one umbrella, under one motif. I can't say that I've seen any evidence that that's really the case. These stories about the Tartarians are as diametrically opposed as they possibly could, meaning you put them all on the wall and you tell the stories one by one and they're all different and they all can't exist at the same exact time. But the movement itself, which is to basically say, look, we're studying history and we're studying why all these structures have been found in these absolutely remote locations with brilliant, brilliant architecture. That's something you need to look at and acknowledge. I mean, you know, technically speaking, we do know that they, the people that want to confuse us, could also manufacture photographs out of AI. And, you know, oh, that building used to be there in Peru in the jungle, but it really wasn't. We had some AI did. It was just a test, and then we floated this shit everywhere. I mean, friends are sending me AI pictures of buildings that don't exist, you know, that have been synthesized. And the only reason why you know they're not real is they're trying to be old sepia-toned photographs, and they're utterly picture-perfect pixelation, or the architecture wouldn't really work in the real world. Meaning the building wouldn't be able to hold up. But the ones we've seen are, you know, old photographs that people have had in newspapers and books way before this technology existed. So I think we have to acknowledge a lot of this stuff is actually very, very real. What I don't understand is, and I respect it, but people get into movements like that and they hyper-focused on one particular century. And I appreciate it. But they get angry after they've done a little bit of research in a particular region of time, and then we might question it. I mean, I haven't really had any disputes with anyone individually on this level, but I definitely have asked questions on Telegram as to why certain things were published, and because it's like there's one little addition to the Tartarian movement which is utterly laughable, and if someone has CG'd a bunch of old looking robots. And yes, they did build props and things like that of using pipes and, you know, tin cans and stuff. These robots over the year, they're not robots. They don't actually move. They don't have any mechanics in them. Or maybe they got a little pulley that's moving the arm up and down to some display somewhere to create customer retention or something. But they, you know, they've put together these photographs that show these robots fighting people in the 18th century or 19th century and 1800s. Trying to suggest that this really existed and there were tournaments of robots fighting human beings, and, you know, or they get old pictures of the Disney franchise in the 50s creating the first automatrons, which, you know, were built to look human. And they catch, you know, the back is opened up and there's a bunch of mechanics inside the guts. See, they've had these forever, you know. What's most important to me personally is that history is bullshit. That, you know, whether or not Genghis Khan ever existed, we don't really know. Did Alexander the Great really exist? We don't know. Did any of the Caesars exist? We don't know. Just because there is a stone bust of a face with a name on it means nothing. I mean, really, as far as proof, it means nothing. The pharaohs of Egypt have been lied about. You know, it just depends on who built all the temples as to where the truth might be. Graham Hancock has uncovered what looks like very convincing proof that there was at least 30 to 35,000 years worth of pharaohs documented by name, indicated by year and month on a temple wall. Well, that's interesting. It's a shit ton of people, isn't it? Goes way back further than the 3200 BC years that they say this whole thing began. Still can't acknowledge nor describe why there's no mention of the pyramids in any of the hieroglyphs. Isn't that weird? You know, most societies that have engineering at the level of the pyramids document that shit for only one, if not for only one reason, that it's the way that you would educate the next generation on how to do this stuff. You know, 125 bin pyramids don't build themselves in a day, folks. Where's all that knowledge? Where is it written down? Was it all destroyed? Maybe. Maybe the earth itself is nothing more than a receptacle of experimentation from some outside source. You think you're living in a disk in space? Well, you're really living in a big giant contact lens on the surface of a gigantic entity of some sort. But let's talk about video games again. Because what I'm about to mention, I've talked about it at length in other episodes. But it's very important to remember this and to never forget it. The games that you can play on an average console system are starting to get ultra-realistic looking on your television, right? Let's say you got a 4K television, you got a PS5, the latest Xbox, and you're playing a video game that's had a lot of effort put into it. It's starting to look really photoreal. Now, let's say, because that's a little tiny box that sells for what, maybe, I mean, what, $600 tops if you buy on the first day it comes out? Well, you know that there's people with IBM PCs with the best of the best inside, you know, $8,000 video cards. So let's say that you were rich and you have a video game company that basically says, look, if you're willing to turn all this up and have all the hardware ready, we'll meet you pound for pound, for pixel on your screen. You get an 8K 100-inch screen because you're rich. You buy a $25,000 PC with four video cards in it, 128 gigs of RAM, all solid state drives. The thing's a beast. Water cooled, It never gets hot inside. The video cards never get warm because of the way you've built this machine. That's what you could do today with, say, $30,000. And what you're going to see will utterly blow your mind. It's going to get super duper real. Now, there's some VR headsets out there, but the challenge with the VR headset is that they can't cram the pixels inside the viewing area of the VR headset tight enough so that you don't see the pixels. Your brain will blend them together, but if you concentrate for a split second, you can see the pixels in the screen. Plus, those they all make you cross your eyes. So you get kind of sick after about 30 minutes is the maximum you'd probably be able to push it. They really don't want you to go over 15 minutes per shot. But even if they could create that screen, the problem with the VR headsets that we have today is that they can't pipe the data to the headset, meaning there's too many pixels. If you try to put an 8K monitor inside of a headset using like nanometer LEDs or something, they can't get the data to the headset without killing you. Because the amount of electromagnetic energy that would be going behind your skull would be lethal in a short period of time. But it's only 2023, people. It's only 2023. If you want to have any notion of what's going to happen in, by the end of this century, just go look at a movie from 1923. If it has sound, it's an extremely modern production. James Cagney was doing definitely sound movies by the end of the 20s. What's funny is they don't have any soundtracks to them. They might have an opening song and an ending song during the credits, but you watch a lot of empty rooms with just pitter-patter of feet walking around. It's actually kind of odd. But it's 2023. What are they going to have? Let's just say they don't kill us all. We get past all that. We get rid of all the bad people. Let's say we educate the population like we dearly want it to be educated. We have a couple profound things that are happening. One, quantum computers. Go watch my episode on quantum computers if you don't know what one is. I break it down for you, so hopefully you'll understand no matter how much background you have or how little background you have in science or computers. But within the next 20 years, you're going to have quantum computers that can conceive of every single atom in this world that we can see. In terms of processing anything that they can conceive of, you won't be able to distinguish it with reality. By the end of the century, artificial intelligence will have educated itself to a point where it knows the thresholds of what is good reality and what is surreal reality. You'll have AI that says, I think I made a house. What do you guys think? And those guys are other AIs, and they go, well, I'm a house expert. Well, you know, that doesn't work. Another AI is coming in from a structural standpoint and goes, well, you need a support beam there if you're going to do that. This doesn't even work. And what's the foundation again? Is it sand? Is it bedrock? What do you got? You know, it's going to be able to figure it all out. And with a quantum computer, if it's programmed correctly, it'll take a few decades to get this all sorted out as it did with normal systems back in the 80s. They'll write the algorithms to match the hardware. And when that happens, a progress bar will be a concept of the past. You'll be telling your grandkids that you used to have to wait for things to happen. And now photoreal reality happens right in front of your face. A child in 2100, if this technology continues to grow and if it's continuing to be used as a reality entertainment system, it's going to be like Ray Bradbury's Velt book, where kids just have a holodeck they go into. Now, the other part is the solid state nature of light in a holodeck, meaning a virtual thing actually resists pressure. You reach out to a virtual sofa in your little reality, and it pushes back. But when you turn off the system, the sofa goes away, and its resistance goes away. Now, there's all kinds of ways to approach that particular thing, but just think about that becoming a reality. And you want to talk to me about where you are? What would be the only difference between you living in that reality right now and you living in that reality, say 60 years from now, depending on how old you are. I mean, I envy anybody who's like in their 20s hearing this, because you're going to technically live, if all works out, you're going to hit potentially the end of the century. You're going to see this happen. I may or may not see this happen. I should, but you never know. But what was in existence in the year 1900 in terms of computers? You had an abacus, right? You had some solid state machines that could bubble up an abacus basically and maybe count, but it was very, very, very basic. And in less than 100 years, we had the complete foundation for what I'm telling you, including the quantum computer foundational theories. And that's just the current thing, you know, spinning, phosphorus atoms to use it as a processor. Okay. So how long has man been on this rock, this place, wherever the hell we are in this reality? A long time. How do we know we've been here for a long time? Well, relatively speaking, we don't. But we look at our design and we look at the amazing mechanics of the human body, let alone all the insects, the fish, all the animals in the wilderness and the jungles, and the marriage with all of these living beings and the ecosystem of the place where we live, the oceans and the pollen. This is a whole bunch of work. This is a whole bunch of work. Even if a computer designed us, like the movie The Matrix, and we never ever lived outside this reality in the previous state, conceiving of all of this still takes, I think, millions of years. Millions of years. If an AI computer could do it, that only means, at least at this current state, that man figured it out first. Man taught the AI first. Then the AI went nuts. Let me ask you this. Especially if you've ever been frustrated with someone else's perception of what reality is. And I don't mean mouth breathers. I mean very intelligent fellow man people that you know they're smart. And you're like, man, if you're that guy is really smart or that girl is really smart, I don't know why they believe this stupid thing, whatever it might be. What do you think is most important when you're floating away from your body, returning to whatever source we come from? You've passed away. Your body is no longer going to be your possession. It's going to return dust to dust. What's going to matter? Well, we don't like to put it in these terms, but I'm going to use these terms, which is a trophy. If we meet God, if that is indeed the absolute crowning, I wouldn't say achievement, but the crowning benefit of being on the other side, or any other life force, are they going to care whether or not you figured out what reality you're in? Well, it might be an interesting Chotsky, but, you know, it might be a conversation that goes something like this. Did you ever figure out that we were on that thing, you know, the tetrahedron? You know, I almost got there. Yeah, I didn't figure it out either. All right, that's cool. What do you want to do? Let's go play some golf. Yeah, let's listen to, you know, Michael Jackson or whatever, right? That's about as fast as that conversation, I think, could or as long as that conversation would ever go on the other side. The conversation I think you're going to want to have, the feeling you're going to want to have, the accolade you want to take with you, the attribute of your character that you want to take with you is really related mainly, I think, to common law. Do no harm. Don't leave your body all angry. You could be disappointed in the world and that kind of stuff. That's not the same thing. If we know a human being that is responsible for Agenda 21 and they have dedicated their entire life to exterminating mankind, I'm not saying you got to like that person on your way out or have some infinite forgiveness like Christ himself. Hey, man, if you can do it, thumbs up to you, man. You're a way bigger soul than me, okay? And we don't have to actively wake up and dislike anybody. We can just ignore them. But it's people that you would otherwise enjoy in this world had not an issue been inserted in your life. A debate that, although interesting, wasn't very fruitful for you. Unless you want to be an explorer and you manage to save up a bunch of money and you're like, I'm taking my private G6 and I'm flying over the South Pole. I'm just going to fucking do it. And they can shoot me out of the sky if they want. I'm going to simulcast this thing all over the internet. And I'm going to, you know, have a bunch of people watching me. I'm going to broadcast my intention not to hurt anybody. I'm not going to land anywhere. I'm not going to try to do anything unless I find some world on the other side, right? Okay, that's cool. I don't know if I've personally ever been considering reality being anything other than what they told us to be, meaning I'm thinking about alternate realities where it didn't come down to my moral conduct as a person. I feel like it is an absolute given that I be a good person. Don't step on anybody's head to get ahead. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Use the resources you have to accomplish as much as you possibly can. Create things that benefit others. That could be all kinds of stuff. You know, you could be a good doctor and forbid people from getting toxic injections. You could be a scientist, even if you're not blessed by some college, you could be a scientist that invents the next perpetual motion system. You don't even tell anybody. You just hand it out to poor people wherever they are in the world. And you say, shh, don't say anything. If you tell anybody this exists, they're going to take it away from you. And once we hit critical mass and I've given this, you know, 100 million of these things out, we've lit the entire world from ethereal energy, then we can have this day and we can celebrate where we can tell people what we've been doing. But until then, keep it to yourself, right? Maybe you're an entertainer of some sort. You write books. You make movies. You write songs. You perform on stage. Whatever it is. I know you feel me on that. I think there's clues everywhere that our certainty about where we are, the more we attempt to define it, it sort of makes it a joke on us, in my opinion, right? Why even try to be so sure? Would it change your life that much? If you believe in God, you believe in God. If you don't, you don't. If you're on the fence, you're on the fence. How would knowing where you are somehow enhance that? Well, if God existed, I'd really like God. I don't know too many people that are willing to admit it, but I think that's something that people say to themselves subconsciously. Oh, if there's no God, well, then I'm going to do everything. I'm going to rob banks and do whatever I want in this world. Don't know too many people have that spoken, and I don't know how many people would have that subconsciously. But these are the things a lot of us think about on a daily basis, minute to minute, second to second sometimes. And the frustrating thing is there's really no feedback from the public at large, because we're not supposed to be having these conversations. And the public at large is so preoccupied with nothing half the time. Who's going to go to the Super Bowl bullshit? That they've never contemplated this at all. So you're half a sentence into the conversation about reality and they've lost you. They don't understand the words coming out of your mouth. So if you want to create a group of folks that can learn what you are considering in this world, then you have to get your own thoughts in order. And you probably should start with your smartest friends, your most intelligent friends, I should say. Test out your theories, because you're probably still going to be over most people's heads. And if you truly want to have this conversation, you'll need some disciplines, meaning what you're willing to, how you're willing to approach the conversation, how you're not willing to approach the conversation. One of the things that I get a lot of, if I can find folks with some philosophical education, is that they will pull up Confucius or some other philosopher, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and they've definitely got these amazing moments where they've put a tremendous amount of thought into this. And I think that was probably, if those people even existed, it would have been the most enlightened phase of that region of the world that may have ever existed in the modern recorded history, if, again, these people existed. Someone approached me and said, how do you know that Plato was even real? And well, you know, I can't say. But here's the interesting thing about it. Let's say Plato didn't exist. I don't think that William Shakespeare ever existed. I think he was Francis Bacon, which is why they say that William Shakespeare's grave has a curse on it. Well, of course you say it has a curse on it because there's nobody there. And when someone thought they found his grave, they created a story that not only does it have a curse, but someone stole his body. And then, of course, they don't want to dishonor that. So they say, oh, he was actually picked up by his family, moved someplace else. Whatever. Someone still wrote the plays of Shakespeare. You get it? Someone still came up with all of the sayings that Plato, Socrates said. So someone out there is smart. The knowledge is coming from somewhere. The brilliant parables, which were written in hieroglyphs and later spoken by a character named Jesus Christ. Okay. Those stories still came from somewhere. If you're religious, you might just write it all off and say, well, God created all those stories. God created all those philosophies. All right. I'm not going to disagree because I agree with you. In the end, all things were created. But isn't that a lazy way to end the conversation? There's still more to be understood about what that implies. Now, there's nothing like thinking about a question you can't answer every single day. And you get yourself at that, you know, down that that alleyway in was an Animal House, right? I think that you get stuck in a one-way street in a dead-end alleyway if you apply an intense filter of specificity. I'm going to talk about flat earth, and that's all I'm going to talk about. When I talk about reality, that's all I want to talk about. Can't be anything else other than what I believe. It's got to be globe earth. That's all I believe. We're just going to have it out one day. And whoever kills the other guy, well, whether or not they're right or wrong, whoever's alive gets to pick the shape of the earth. Now, think about that little journey to heaven when you're all said and done and you won, but you're wrong. Maybe the other guy was right. Maybe both of you are wrong, right? We know that the world is becoming utterly self-absorbed. The first stage of being self-absorbed is opulence. You got some money you never had before. You get self-absorbed because you want to satiate all those dreams of things that you wanted when you were a kid. And believe me, I did it. And for luckily for me, I didn't need anything that cost, you know, millions of dollars. But I think a lot of us have done it, especially dudes who get into either cars or electronics or computers or wardrobes or all the above, right? Once you get through that stage, man, there's an interesting moment that starts to happen to you. Because the purpose of your existence starts to be the only thing that's left. And no amount of physical possession is going to satiate that answer. Or should I say question? I think this reality is full of clues. Tons of clues. You have the really esoteric theoretical clues, like I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, which is the numeric system of counting. The fact that you know how to count to infinity. You know how to do it. You can't accomplish it in your lifetime, but you know how to do it. The sky is a very interesting canvas of mystery, right? During the day, it's blue. It's opaque. Can't see through it. If the moon is in your hemisphere, well, you can see that. What the hell is that thing? Well, at night, the blue dissolves away and a bed of stars is visible. If you're out in the middle of a desert, the human eye can see roughly about 1,200 stars. What are they? Why do all shooting stars fall to the ground? I mean, there's all kinds of interesting things, right? I'm finding in this day and age that man has lost the ability to acknowledge observable reality. And there's a lot of you that know this, and that's why you are very convicted in your beliefs. And I absolutely commend you 100,000% for having that conviction. But because there's an agenda around a particular thought process, it gets pigeonholed. You have an open mind in this one area, but for whatever reason, sometimes when you cross over into another paradigm of thought, it closes again. One of the most interesting paradigms of having your mind opened is when you fall in love with another human being. That unbelievably intangible thing to describe that's called love. When you look into someone else's eyes and this magic thing happens in your chest. You have to say goodbye to them for a few hours, and when you leave, you feel like you're breathing fresher air through your lungs. You feel like your blood supply has been infused with some frickin' particles that make the Force in Star Wars. I mean, you feel amazing. When you hear their voice on a telephone or the phone rings and you know it's going to be them on the other side, or you've just opened the door to where you live and you know they're in there in the kitchen, half-dressed, making dinner, or whatever. And that's before you get to all the hanky-panky. There's this magic envelope that blows the whole paradigm open. But what's fascinating about it, and I am just as guilty as anybody, you're so myopically focused on the benefits to your own life and that love moment that we don't stop to think about the bigger picture of where all this emotion comes from. Scientists will, of course, say it's a bunch of dopamine dropping in your brain. Well, you know what's interesting about those theories of the brain being completely accountable as a chemical bag for your love emotions? And this is going to be funny if you've never thought about this. If you take a drug of any kind, it is cannibalizing all of those chemicals in your brain. Like when you play a video game or watch a good movie, good writers and good game designers know about the chemistry of the brain. I teach a course on it in college. You have to pace rewards for how the brain is capable of creating a new batch of chemicals. You can't just go orgasm, 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 orgasm. Your body can't create the orgasm over and over and over again. You simply don't have the chemicals to do that. As much as you might think, ladies. But isn't it interesting that a good moment of staring into someone's eyes that you love, or curling up on a sofa or whatever, is so much more amazing than the highest heroin trip you could ever take, LSD trip, cocaine trip. For those of you who actually feel good getting high on weed, which is not me, those folks, that would mean that within hours of being in love with someone, your brain would be so utterly drained of this chemical responsibility for those emotions that you wouldn't be able to feel it the next day. You'd probably be depressed and kill yourself the next day because you'd be so empty. But you don't, do you? The next day you wake up next to that person, or you're rolling over in the middle of the night, and they're right there, warm, full of love for you. You're burping up love for them. I mean, it's just an infinite thing. It ain't chemicals in your brain, people. Oh, I'm sure you could study the brain and some shit's moving around here and there, but in terms of that feeling, how do we describe God? I mean, if you're really pushed to describe God, how is God ever described? God is always described as a loving, infinitely forgiving being, made of love, if you really get to a decent person who can really explain it. Infinite. And when you fall in love with something or someone, but definitely someone, man, your kids can do it to you. You feel this thing, this special thing. Virtually everyone who's ever heard my voice has already felt this numerous times, even if you're not in it right now. So, let's go back to those experiments that intelligence agencies have spent billions of dollars researching. What if someone just had an epiphany at some brainstorming session and said, you know what it is? It's just falling in love. That's when our society is the most healthy, when they're all falling in love. Remember the baby boomer thing that happened? Everyone was living in fear from 1929 to 1945 when World War II ended. The Depression absolutely raped them in the 30s. And you lived in fear. You lived in uncertainty. And all of a sudden, we won. It was over. And now everyone starts falling in love. Because that's all they had left was love. They had been denied love for 15 years. And all of a sudden, a bunch of people were born. Television got amazing. Movies got amazing. I mean, it was like the world was made of love. Things were being made out of love. So if you look at the world now and you're like, well, Jesus, I don't really feel like the world is really trying to make me fall in love with anyone or anything. I mean, I'm freaked out about everything. Well, that world is what we call reality. a paradigm of reality. If you want to look at the high crimes and misdemeanors of the elite of this world, it is to deny you the very fabric to feel love. And they are so systemically devious about it that they've got the men addicted to a bunch of things that will make them utterly repulsive, and women the same. So even when you find a candidate, let's just say, well, they're all screwed up. Bunch of people have a poison floating around in their blood now. It's even worse, right? So where are you? What matters? What needs to be fixed in this world? What are you tired of, right? You know what's fascinating is, there's a bunch of us that can go into a restaurant without our cell phone. And even though it's a little bit weird, because we've had cell phones now that are smart for at least 10 years, we're used to looking at every little red dot on every application, you still practice not taking it with you. If you go out on a date or you go to dinner with someone, you leave it in the car. And there's nothing worse than having them bring theirs and you don't bring yours and they're in their phone all the time. They've been convinced by the system to adopt an even tinier reality in a tiny little screen. And I'm going to throw a ridiculous analogy at you, but it's the overall example that's important. And I'm going to give you an analogy before. I'm going to give an example of it before in a fictional sense. The musician John Denver made two movies in the late 70s, early 80s called Oh God. And George Burns, the old actor who lived 100 years and smoked cigars until he was 96, he was God. John Denver's character packed groceries at a grocery store and was an atheist. And here comes George Burns as God saying, "You're my chosen one, and you need to deliver a message for me." I think the message was, "Thank God," or something like that. But of course, John's like, "Well, I don't even believe that God exists, so how the hell could you, just an old man?" And of course, through demonstration, he proved to him that he was indeed who he said he was, and John helped him out. So a message was broadcast around the world through a word-of-mouth thing. I think there was maybe some news coverage as well on the movie. I haven't seen it for years. But what would happen to all of these narrative-pushing organizations? A lot of them are news organizations, channels on public television. If we just stop watching them. Well, I mean, just stop completely. I once talked to a guy, this is going to fold into this, because you might be going, "Well, that's a great analogy, dude, but that's, you know, you're not living in reality. None that's accessible to the most of us, right?" Before Donald Trump became president, I was talking to a guy at a smoke lounge, and he said, "Well, you know that Hillary's going to throw this election. You just know she is. There's just no way that they're going to let that guy become, doesn't matter." And for some reason, I mean, I totally understood what he was saying, and I agree with them on one level, but I said, you know, if we don't start changing our thinking, then of course nothing's going to change. So instead of saying that to everyone you meet and trying to act like you've got a big drop on reality, "Oh man, you know how smart I am? Let me tell you who's not going to be president, who is going to be president." Well, it didn't happen that way, did it? But I remember him looking at me and I said, "Well, why do you do that? You're just basically picking the worst seconds you could possibly have. Is that the second you want to live in?" I said, "I'm picking the other second." Now, I got my second. He didn't get his second unless he went off to another reality. And I got a copy of him in my reality going, "What the fuck," right? How many people have televisions in their house with subscriptions to services that give ratings away? How many times do we go on sources of information and we sit and watch something that you would normally have to pay for? I know this might seem like it's obscure to this particular charter in this episode, but it really isn't. I always tell people, I say, you know, the reason why, because women will always get to a point when you get into deep conversations with them, will say, "Well, you men age really, really well, and us women don't." And I said, that's because women designed men and men designed women. And they go, what the hell are you talking about? And I said, well, think about it. You guys chose who you wanted to mate with. So you designed us, all of the male genes that are existing today in every race, no matter if you're a male and you look in the mirror, sorry, there's only two genders, sorry. If you look in the mirror, you were designed by the opposite sex. Now, why would it be that women would, in their opinion, not age as well as men? And the idea is that men don't care as much about that thing. As long as we can make some sweet loving, eat and go to sleep, just like Dr. Laura used to say, for a lot of us dudes and the traditional archetype of a man, that's all we needed. And we didn't judge you for getting older. We didn't judge you for gaining a pound. But women cared about that kind of stuff. Some women don't. That's why you got pot belly dudes that just genetically get there. That's just how it happens. And there's always someone who loves the living shit out of you exactly the way you are. But I think that's generally how it works. Our choices as a group of people cause major effects down the line. In just a very short distance of time, if you watch old American movies, you can find, I'm seeing it from mainly the male perspective. The women in those movies no longer exist. Their DNA doesn't exist. These super refined women who have rules about how they handle themselves, about who they're going to allow themselves to be married to, there were rules. And they're so dignified and so refined and so, I don't know, just a major upgrade from everything that's available today. Now, they still exist. They're like needles in haystacks today. But, and I know I'm talking about a fictional situation, but hey, all the old ladies in my hometown, they sat up straight. They didn't swear. You know, I mean, it seemed like it was everywhere. But through indoctrination of false realities projected at us through a television system, and perhaps the silver screen, mostly television, because that's pound for pound, you know, probably 9-to-1 ratio of consumption. We had a reality projected at us that wore us down, that made us an embarrassment to ourselves in many cases. Men that don't grow up, women that don't grow up, all the responsibilities and all of the stages of life that I think our Creator set down for us are now trivialized, right? Getting married is a trivial thing. I don't want to do that. Having a kid, I don't want to do that. Now, some people just know they don't want to do it. They have a very different life. I get it. But overall, there are stages of becoming a grandparent. Getting older. I mean, that's something we never can escape, right? As long as we live long, well, we're going to get old. We're going to look in that mirror and go, holy shit, who's that dude? Who's that chick, right? There's so much of our reality that's so subjective and it's hands-on. And then there's that reality that we started this conversation out with, which is the existential location and purpose as to why the hell are we here? What is this place? What am I made out of? Even if I could prove the whole universe is made out of ether, which is what I believe it's made out of at this particular cosmology, I don't know that I would have settled my curiosity when it comes to reality. There's an old saying that you know very well, and it's called ignorance is bliss. And what's really sad about the truth of that statement, because it is utterly true, is that one can't truly know the definition until you have ruptured the membrane, and you can never return to being blissfully ignorant. You become hyper-intelligent. You look back and go, what did I just do? You know? And of course, there's rewards on both sides of the fence. But the word bliss is pretty appealing, isn't it? And so what a lot of us do, I think a lot of you and I do, is we struggle to find bliss on the other side of that threshold. Being intelligent. Being aware. Being empathetic towards the rest of the world that you know is suffering, and there's nothing you can do. But you're trying to find some oasis, some Garden of Eden on this other side. As I get older, for me, one of the satiating qualities of just existing is realizing how short this journey really is. It's an incredibly short journey. So short that it is logically not the end of the journey. It is merely the end of my identity this time around. Now, I don't know about you, but the more I adopt this theory, and it is a theory that I am developing inside myself, I would say involuntarily, meaning I think it's revealing itself to me more than I am inventing it, that indeed the way that you treat your being in this reality potentially will offer you a more sophisticated reality in the next realm with less suffering, more productivity. And the only way that there's an upgrade that's going to take place is if I really take care of this, my intentions as I express in my actions and perhaps my words, although I think words can be forgiven as you work things out. Like if you think you were going to have a big argument with somebody, like I always tell you guys, get in your car, go away from that person, shout it out like you're really just letting it all, I mean, get nasty, get crazy. And then when you hear yourself say it out loud, you'll laugh at yourself and go, my gosh, I'm so glad I didn't say any of that crap in front of anybody else. By the time you get with the other person that you thought you were going to have this big knockdown drag out with, you can't even fathom saying the things you just said in your practice session. It's very good for you. So again, I do think that words can be instrumental in working things out without becoming a permanent attribute of your character. Even if you say horrific things, you're just letting the demons out of your system, if you want to have an analogy, in my opinion. I think we're here to create as much as we're here to experience. If anything else, just think about being a celebrity on stage, performing. Probably easier to make it a musician of some sort, but maybe even an actor on a stage play, right? It's live, it's visceral. There's an audience staring at you. Hot lights are on your face. You've had to endure decades of training and figuring out your craft. You had to memorize what you're doing, whether you're playing an instrument or saying lines. And as much as you love what you do and you want to continue doing it, you also want to sit in the audience every once in a while, have someone entertain you. But what if the audience never did what you did? Then you would be the only one entertaining anybody. And the analogy there is, don't just be an audience member of this reality. That's my advice. Get involved with your reality as whatever you see it to be. But it doesn't matter what shape the ground is that you're sitting on or standing on. It just doesn't matter. It's cool if you find out, you know, if that's what you want to do to figure it out, then get tenacious with it, save up money and do an experiment. But in the end, that's probably more for you than for anybody else. Being kind, I think, is easy for some people, and I think it's much more difficult for others, especially if people haven't been kind to you. But a lot of times, it's the people who have had everyone be kind to them that are the biggest jerks in the world, right? Let them eat cake, as it was. Reality is up for grabs in the next 100 years. Deep fake is proving it to you every single day. We're not going to be able to trust any artificial imagery in 5 to 10 years. And when I say that, I know a lot of you are going to say, well, you really can't trust it today. And you're not wrong. But the measurement of absolute in this realm is going to be achieved in at least 10 years, I think. And so there's going to be a doctrine that will probably evolve out of the experience of those who are more intelligent. And believe me, there's the forces of people that are developing this technology and using it to deceive you that are going to keep you from ever getting the stronghold. You're going to be the next Charles Manson if you try to keep reality, observed reality, the game. You're going to be a hippie. Oh, those people don't watch TV. Yeah, they don't like anything that's on TV because they say it's fake. Well, it is fake, Dad. Well, that's not the point, right? There may come a time when you're like, I'm going to create a ranch somewhere with 100 houses or whatever, tents. And the people who live there are going to basically say, like The Village, the movie The Village, right? They're basically going to say, look, we just don't want to have any influence from the outside world. When I have a conversation with a human being, it's because I'm standing there looking at their face. not because it's over Zoom or Skype or whatever, FaceTime of any kind, because it's the only thing I can trust. Again, it's infinitely divisible, isn't it? You can multiply it infinitely. And you do it every single day. What are the stars? Well, that's a macro multiplier of what is reality. Hey, I can't trust anybody unless I'm staring at the subdermal, you know, readings of their blood flushing through their face when I'm making a deal. Well, that's a divisible example of how you're sifting reality. You want that feedback. You want to see if they're lying to you. Anybody could put on a show over a Skype call. In reality, well, if they got to walk across the parking lot from their car to your business, stare you in the face for several hours, go to lunch with you while they're eating, and you're hitting them with all kinds of questions that just they didn't expect to answer. Then they get done, you shake hands, and you try to make a deal, and they got to walk back to their car, and you're watching them the whole way as to whether or not they break character and acknowledge that they just screwed you or whatever. They're great. They're happy they got the deal with you. They feel like they're the luckiest person in the world, like someone coming off Shark Tank, swinging their fists in the air and screaming, hell yeah. We got to get good at the reality we're in too. I know you feel me. I wanted to make one of these episodes because it's been a long time. So hopefully this is entertaining to you. I'm going to be doing the ones without the video off and on as time permits, because I don't want to be losing episodes just because I don't have a really cool place to set up. I got some ideas to make that a little bit easier that I'll be engaging in the next couple months here, but I want to get some episodes out. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, just know all the sources of the show are up there. Most of them are on independent sites that don't have any censorship whatsoever. In terms of the chaos reports, I just want to say I'm going to keep one live at any one point in time. If another one goes up, the old one gets deleted. Because just because it's so timely in current affairs, they have very little value, even a month past the information. But I'll keep them coming. To the PayPal and Patreon folks, thank you so much for hanging in there during this lean transition of the new year. Sorry I got so busy. But anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.